Talking about
Western Electric.
Yeah, Western Electric and working with Dean Knapik, mm-hmm. making that connection. And you were also mentioning that Eugene Kleiner, did he work at that same plant?
He worked the same factory. In fact, Gene and I and Knapik were in the same carpool together for many years.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Were you all living in Queens then?
And no, I was living in Queens, and Gene was living on the west side, up in the 80s, right, and Dean was living on the east side of Manhattan, and we'd alternate. Gene some days used to drive, and some days I used to drive. Knapik didn't have a car, so he sort of helped pay the way for the tolls across the way.
Right.
And we did this for a number of years. That's how we, you know, we got acquainted with one another.
How did you, was that just something that evolved at work, or were you guys particularly friendly with one another?
No, it just evolved at work.
Yeah.
You know, on the job, I didn't have much to do with Gene, except he used to work, you know, he was working four rows of desks up ahead of me in the relay gang.
Okay.
And I was a few rows behind him in the crossbar crowd. And Dean was in a separate section doing some, as I say, generic work, and he had a wire wrapping project that he was trying to get put in to spread throughout the whole company. Kleiner had to get involved in it because he had to change the shape of their relay terminals to accommodate the wire wrapping.
This was how to wrap the
wire around the terminal without solder.
Okay.
What you do, you wire up enough pressure so that the corners form the metallurgical bond with the wire.
Okay.
A gas-tight metallurgical bond. I was told a good electrical connection is a good mechanical connection. Okay?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it required a massive change of form factor for all the terminals that were built. And we did start to introduce this, and after a while, in the beginning, they wouldn't let us ship equipment without solder. So we had to do the wire wrap and do the solder. And after we collected, I don't know how many reams of data supporting that they were good, then we'd have a test run of
right.
So many hundred thousand. They were good on collecting supporting evidence to make before they went anything. Yeah, Weston was an interesting place, too. I learned, the first time I saw a clean room was at the shop they had in Hillside, New Jersey, where they were making the submarine or underwater cable.
Right.
This was a project, you know, to behold. They were building these repeaters.
Mm-hmm. That would go under sea.
That would get spliced into the cable and it would go underwater. And a repeater in those days was an amplifier that was made out of vacuum tubes. They used to call them rocket tubes. And each tube was designed to have a service life of 20 years at least double full rated power.
Wow.
So they didn't want to get up there and change tubes in the middle of the ocean.
Right.
And this cable would handle power and transmission lines simultaneously. This is a trick by itself. Anyway, they were building these things in clean. First time I saw guys with hats and bunny suits building the amplifiers.
Okay, because they didn't want anything in there.
They wanted to make
could.
Sure there was no. And even they had a fetish of keeping vibration away from it. I couldn't understand why, because the thing sits in the ocean, it's weightless, right? Well, I saw pictures of how they were laying this cable. They had this huge reel, maybe 20 foot in diameter or more. Must be more like 100 foot, I couldn't tell from the scale. With this cable wrapped around it, and they're paying it out, and as soon as they empty that one, they clip on another one and keep on going with this thing. And, you know, in the calm sea, it's one thing, but every once in a while, in the pitching sea, this thing would go up and down, and this cable would whack into the water with a shock load. They calculated how many G's it was. It was pretty striking. It had to survive that. If it could survive that, it would last forever.
Okay.
Because it had no strain under the water.
Right. So when did Knapik leave for the West Coast. Did you know? I mean, did you talk with him about that?
He was a very talkative guy. Uh-huh. He told us he was being interviewed by Bill Shockley. And of course, we know that he was an exaggerator, so, you know, okay, interesting story. Well, it turns out that Shockley, when he set up his lab, was looking for some mechanical or, you know, manufacturing people, because he knew that most the scientific variety of the day didn't have much experience with that.
Right.
And they were not always practical, and he needed somebody to do things practical for them. And so he called one of his buddies at Bell Labs. I think the fellow's name was Rudy Molina, who was a friend of Shockley's. And he knew of Dean because he worked with him on this project. And he gave him a call. He mentioned it to Shockley, and Shockley got in touch with him and invited him out. So he went. He actually went and took a look, and he had to go and take this this test for McMurray Hamster, which is a psychological. You've undoubtedly heard about this.
I have heard about it.
And he told him, he gave him the authority to go ahead and find two more engineers to help round out this project. And he picked yours truly and Gene Kleiner out of the whole gang. Not only did he pick me, the only ones that had an interest in showed interest in going. Most of the fellows wouldn't even touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Because just they were established where they were, or
but who, yeah, all of the above, all of the, they didn't have any courage. And we were talking about going to the West Coast anyway at one time, but looking for an opportunity that didn't, you know, that we had some recourse in case it didn't work out. So, and eventually, I got interviewed by Shockley. He flew in. I met him at the Newark Airport at the restaurant up there, and we chatted for a couple of hours over lunch, and I got a letter offering me a job out there, and same thing with Gene Kleiner.
So for how long had Knappich, I mean, Knappich must have been one of the first people out there.
No, there must have been about 10 people there when he got there.
Okay.
Maybe some technicians and a few guys. I think there was Smoot Horsley and Knapp, Bill Happ, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
and Leo Valdez, and a couple of technicians. It wasn't very many people. And Vic Jones was there.
Okay. Now, of those people, had Smoot Horsley been in Bell or part of
I don't
that
know.
System?
I never knew uh-huh. anything about. I didn't know much about him.
Okay. But Leo
Leo Valdez had been at Bell.
Right.
I didn't know him. I didn't know very many people at Bell.
Mm-hmm.
So didn't mean anything to me. But
right.
He left Bell to work with Pacific Semiconductor making diodes in Los Angeles, and Shockley picked him up to work there. A real physicist, a Bell Lab type physicist. Nice fellow, actually. But not too practical, but that's another story.
So when you met with, was that early 1956 then when you met with Shockley at the airport?
Yeah, that must have been January, I don't remember. I
mm-hmm.
think. It was early 56.
And did he... did he describe to you then, or early on in the whole conversation about what he wanted to do with Shockley Semiconductor?
Not really. I didn't think he knew. His main thrust was silicon. He
mm-hmm.
wanted to focus on silicon and in ways to make devices out of it. They weren't sure whether they're going to do alloying or diffusion or. I don't know, they had a few other little pet things, but they were exploring to find out what the best way it was, and they didn't even know what to make, even, just to make it a transistor with silicon.
Right.
That was the thing that he was focusing on, because he felt that germanium had its limitations, and although silicon was harder, there was more of it in the universe than there was germanium, which I agree.
So is that when did you did you come out to California to see the operation before you decided, or?
No, just packed up, sold whatever furniture I could deal with, sold the car. I actually had the guy that sold the car to drive me to the airport. Had a we had a, our child, first child was 10 months old at the time. So we go to Idlewild Airport. It wasn't JFK at that then, in New York.
Uh-huh. And
got on a Constellation and flew to California in April of 56. Almost 10 years to the day that I got out of the Army.
And did you then, did you have some time to do apartment or house hunting before you started?
We had a few days, and we wound up, we came here on a Wednesday, and by Saturday we bought a house. Having looked to discover there were no rentals around,
okay,
apartments, and no rentals of houses that would take young infants.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to buy a house, and we bought one. And we stayed in this motel in Palo Alto here until our furniture arrived, at which time we took delivery and moved right in.
Did you buy a house in Palo Alto?
Palo Alto.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe we could talk about just your first impressions of the laboratory when you got there, and
well, having come from a sophisticated place like Western Electives, was kind of primitive. Just strictly laboratory equipment. It was a small machine shop, and I knew that was not going to be adequate enough because you have to build everything.
Right, all
they
the
had
equipment.
Nothing, even little fixtures you had to build. They already had a couple of people there, but you could see that wasn't going to be enough, didn't have enough capacity. And so we expanded the shop. And the first job I had was to build this fancy crystal grower.
Okay, this was the one that Shockley and Jones had devised?
Yeah, and Leo.
Okay.
And it was a kludge, in my opinion, but okay, we're going to build this crystal grower. And unfortunately, it got to be a project that got much bigger than we really could handle, to the point where it was going to take a while before we could get crystals. And we decided that, look, we're going to need silicon. And he was Shockley was able to get silicon from Bell. And we could buy some once in a while from Sarks-Tarsian just to do experimental.
I haven't heard of that Sarks-Tarsian.
Yeah, they were, I think they were from Indiana, I think, but it was a company that was growing some silicon crystals that they would sell. Sarkes hyphen Tarsian, Tarzian, or IEN, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You might find it on.
I'll look into it.
Yeah. And this was a hit and miss kind of a thing, and so we decided that we ought to get a crystal, make our own crystals, because it was going to be a while before this thing got going. And you could buy a crystal grower from a company in New England or New York, I've forgotten which, but it was expensive and it was a long delivery time, and it was a RF. Mm-hmm. Heated device, took a 20 kilowatt lapel generator, and he wanted a lot of money for it, and the time delay. So I decided, look, we could build one of our own, and have it running by the time these guys would even think of delivering it, because one of the pacing items was getting the generator itself anyway.
Just purchasing it.
And having it shipped and just getting a delivery position.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
So we decided to go ahead and build a crystal grower, which I did. Gene and I sat around, we decided to build one, and we designed and built a mechanism to pull crystals.
A simpler one than the...
Yeah, just the one that's going to work.
Yeah.
That had a quartz envelope,
mm-hmm.
and just a pedestal. To hold a graphite pedestal to hold a susceptor with a quartz
right.
you know, bowed in, you know, the quartz, you know, bowl, and, you know, chopped with the seed that you mount the seed on and rotate it and pull it, so on. And
did so you pull it under a gas? Or?
Yeah, oh yeah, you had to use an atmosphere of pure nitrogen as you could get with a little argon in it, which was a trick that we learned from Bell.
Mm-hmm.
Just a few percent, I forget, maybe 2 or 3% argon in it. It was all it took to make life a little easier.
Now that sounds like, I have a couple questions about the big grower.
Right.
But
you really don't want to waste time with that. It was a story by itself, but it's all
right.
Well,
it seems, I think it is interesting just in terms of the Shockley semiconductor experience, because it was from what I've heard, well, just to talk about the big growers for a minute, it seems like it must have been, in terms of the early days of the lab, a lot of people working on it. Must have been, it was large scale physically.
Very large.
Very complicated, so it must have been expensive.
Not that complicated.
Oh, really?
Expensive. Well, what it was we built a double wall steel tank.
Right.
You keep water on the outside just to cool it down. With covers on, well, it looked like a little mini boiler, which was, you know, right up my alley. And inside was a crucible that was going to be heated by a resistance wire element wrapped around radiation shields. There were 2 or 3 layers of radiation shields around there, and the outer one had the had a molybdenum wire. Actually, it was 3 phases. We had a 3-phase wire wrapped around the outside with standoff insulators to keep it from shorting out to the molybdenum radiation shield. And the whole idea was to heat the whole thing up to just below the melting point of silicon.
Right.
You're gonna melt it first, and then back off just before it gets fluid, which is a funny place, you know, this
phase.
I knew from my thermodynamics that this is a very unstable place.
Mm-hmm.
Better, right? And then the idea was he's going to put a separate heating element with a piece of tantalum wire as a heating element to melt a puddle inside of this from which you're going to pull the crystal.
Right.
Which is supposed to be not to have contact with the quartz crucible,
right,
quartz element. The theory was he didn't want to get any oxygen in there.
Mm-hmm. And you'd pull it under a vacuum.
Under negative pressure, let's put it that way. You're not going to get a thing like that with anything that you would call, in my book anyway, anything nearly like a vacuum. It was under some, as much negative pressure as you could get out of it.
Okay.
Which I wasn't too happy with either. I'd rather put it under positive pressure with a known gas.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what am I, you know, I'm just a blacksmith engineer. What am I? Anyway, that was an interesting fiasco with that thing. We were going to build these standoff insulators with, high temperature like that, 1400 C, which is pretty toasty.
Yeah.
With the voltages, which are not so big, maybe 300 volts or thereabouts, not so terrible. I said, the only thing that's going to handle this is the aluminum oxide insulated, which I know because the muffles in the furnaces were aluminum oxide, electric furnaces, right? That they can handle that all day long. That's what you use. Leo Valdez says, absolutely not. It's not pure enough. You have to use sapphire. I said, sapphire? How do we get that? He said, well, they now grow sapphire rods about 1/4 inch diameter, about 2-3 inches long. Sapphire, this is hard stuff. And we argued with him, Gene and I, because, you know, this is a son of a bitch to do or to try to do. You got to use diamond saws to do anything with it. You can't really machine it. You could just cut grooves in it and hope for the best. He insisted. And I think that was a pacing item because the delivery time on that was lengthy. I don't remember what it was, but it wasn't instant delivery. And then when you get it, you have to fiddle around with it to try to figure out how you're gonna cut it and design it. Oh, we did it anyway. We got the thing fired up. Everything is running smoothly, and all of a sudden, bang, the circuit breakers. I thought they were gonna bolt, they were gonna fly off the wall. And a big short. Well, it turns out, to make a long story short, that Vic Jones showed me a thing in the lab that shows that at a certain temperature, sapphire, I think he said it was like a Curie point.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't believe that because Curie has to do with the magnetic properties. So it's not Curie point.
I don't know.
No. Well, I'm...
Okay, sorry.
It don't make any sense. And what happened was that at a certain temperature, the sapphire loses too much strength.
Okay.
So it can't, at that temperature, it can't hold itself up anymore. And the wires sag and short up against the box. Well, that was a major fiasco. And we had to redesign the thing, and we had to go back and we did aluminum oxide. Like we said in the first place, well, aluminum oxide, you make this stuff, it comes like chalk, high strength chalk, you cut it up, mill it, do whatever you want with it, and then you fire it up and heat it up and it becomes a ceramic.
Okay.
And you had a few little tricks you had to learn. Well, we had to learn, we got some books out from the manufacturer that told us what kind of shrinkage allowances to make. It's not a big part, so it really didn't matter very much. You're not talking about a big scale. Anyway, we got this thing where it worked like a charm. And by that time, they had sort of lost interest in it, and it sat idle for a long time. And it was about then that I left the company anyway.
Okay.
In the meantime, we were busy working on the real crystal gourd. I was actually making crystals.
And that sounds like one just, very much on the design of Gordon Teal and John Little. Or where'd you get the...
No, I knew what happened. What it was a tube of quartz with a little viewing port, bolted onto it in between two plates. And what I did was, from my early, I decided to make it like a tensile testing machine, because it was what you had to build. I built a four-poster to hold this. I wanted a rigid platform.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to draw this thing up, so I had two lead screws pulling the platform up. And I didn't want any gears in there, because I don't need any noisy stuff or clutches or shifting.
Uh-huh.
I didn't want to be bothered with that. I didn't think we needed the complication. So what I found was a very large DC variable speed motor,
mm-hmm.
which could go from 1 or 2 RPM up to 1800
okay.
smoothly. So and it had enough torque in any range, so it was enough. It was oversized for the job, but I was more concerned with the speed range than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I had two gear, worm gear transmission on each side turning these screws. So for pulling, you need very slow rate of, and there's another motor on top turning the rod, the chuck rod. And there was we drilled a hole in there to go ahead and introduce the gas,
mm-hmm.
And on the bottom we put a radiation pyrometer, which was made by Leeds and Northrop with a controller.
Mm-hmm.
The best of its kind, the only one of its kind in those days. And there it was. I remember we were drawing this thing up. I had a draftsman doing the drawings, and he's trying to put a dimension on this plate to hold the table up. I said, don't waste your time, because I didn't even know what that is yet. He said, why? He said, we have to put a name around. I said, first of all, I don't want to wait 6 months for somebody to ship it out from God knows where, just because it's that dimension.
Okay.
I want to see what's available for it. So I went to a shop that we were working with, and he said, you got to go to a place that has a big grinder. I said, do you know anybody around that has a Blanchard grinder? He says, yeah, there's a guy in Redwood City you go to. So I went to see him, and sure enough, he's got this nice Blanchard. And I said, I need a couple of plates. I told him what it was, and He says, come on in the backyard. And so, you know, this is not engineer to engineer, this is machinist to machinist now. So I went in the back, and he had some boilerplate sitting in the back yet. And I said, well, this looks pretty flat. I said, all I want is enough of a table to hold it up. I said, give me at least a half inch, 5/8, 3/4 would be fine. So he had a couple of pieces of boilerplate, inch and a half thick. I said, that'll do fine. He says, wait, I don't know how much you're going to have left by the time, because it's not flat. So we have it picked up, we bring it to the blanchard, we're sitting there, I figure, how are you going to deal with this? He says, okay, first thing we're going to do is not going to put, you know, the blanchard grinder is a big table with it's basically a magnetic chuck. Okay. With a huge magnet on there that rotates, and right above is a big spindle with a big grinding wheel about that big around.
All right.
And this rotates and that rotates, and pretty soon you generate a flat surface. So what we did first, we put it on there and just brought the wheel down to just kiss the edge of the steel and slowly take off a little bit until you got sort of enough of a flat. And then we turned it over and we did the same thing on the other side. And we kept on, this is craziness, but that's the only way you're going to get a piece of flat metal. And then when it got flat, then we put the power on and finish it off, the magnet, because you didn't want to warp it.
Right.
But when you get through taking the magnet off, it's going to go spring back again. You don't want to do that.
Okay, right.
So this is the kind of thing that you deal with. You know, I understood that you're not going to, I didn't want to waste a lot of time waiting for things to get shipped out from New York or Chicago or Dallas or Boston or wherever, unless you had no choice.
Right.
And so a lot of things we did are not maybe the best practice, but in the interest of saving time, I think the trade-off was worth it, because you got the thing up and running. Well, tell you a story. Our friend at Hewlett Packard was going to make silicon diodes for their own use. And we used to visit back and forth. He actually bought one of those crystal growers that we were looking at. We got ours designed and up and running before his arrived. Okay?
Right.
In fact, we were passing seeds back and forth. You want one of this version? Okay, we'll give you a piece of this. You'll give me what you got. And that was the way it worked. He was doing it all by himself. But his was a flimsy machine compared to ours.
Did you go look at commercial one?
It had a single column with a cantilever, you know, holding this rod in there. You've probably seen pictures of that one.
I'm not sure. I didn't realize that there was a sort of a commercial crystal grower.
Sort of commercial, yeah. It was a semi-metals or something. I don't even remember the name anymore.
Yeah.
Or a general semi or someplace out back east that had these things. And they wanted a lot of money for it, and the delivery time was terrible because they had to be hand-built. You know, I designed it and had it built, like I say, in less time than it took to ship it out of New York or East Coast or wherever it was.
So in your crystal grower, the second, you know, of your design, you were basically raising up a platform?
No, we had a platform that was just table height.
Okay.
A little higher than this.
Yeah.
And on top of that, we set the quartz tube.
Right.
And we pulled, the quartz tube was maybe about 15 inches high or something like that. And then the pulling rod was above that.
Okay, when it was connected to the motor, how was?
There was a separate motor pulling, sitting on the platform where the pulling rod motor was.
Okay.
So that the platform that had the chuck for the pulling rod went through a bearing.
Okay.
And this was driven by a small variable speed motor again.
Mm-hmm.
A little Bodine motor geared down, so it was only turned. You could have some control over it.
So you dip the seed into the melt.
You get the thing started one way.
Right, and then
then you turn it on automatic and it starts pulling up.
Okay, it just pulls directly on that rotating.
Yeah,
rod.
And you watch it, and as the mass changes, you have to change the heat input.
Right.
And that was what the controller was doing, just looking at the bottom of the crucible, and changing the input setting to the RF generator.
Okay, to keep it as semi.
Now we decided the RF generator was a very expensive tool. We decided, you know, we're not gonna have a room full of these things, you know, because every time he's been around, you gotta throw a big 20 kilowatt low, or actually more than that, online. So we developed a resistance heating device. We actually made what was going to hold the crucible instead of a susceptor for coupling.
Yeah.
Which is made out of the same reactor grade graphite. I learned about reactor grade graphite. And we actually cut a double helix out of graphite and split it. Okay. And we drilled holes in there and put bolted clamps of tantalum and fed through the feed through the bottom of the plate and heated up, and you got this, when graphite is cold, even the thing is a nice spring, you know, you wouldn't think about it, but and we heated up, and that was also used for a while too, because you didn't have the expense of an RF generator, and this thing took only a couple of kilowatts instead of 20 or 30.
Right. So you made a resistance crystal grower there?
Yeah, we made it. I don't think we actually built it. We did it. I did it later at Fairchild.
Uh-huh.
We built a fancy one. We built a three phase. We made a triple helix, a bigger one.
Okay.
And that ran for many years. Those crystal growers were pumping out day and night. I talked to some of the maintenance guys on that. He said the only problem they had, they heard a squeak in one of the motors. One time they figured out one of the transmissions had never had grease in it. So what he did was he got a grease gun, he did a couple of squirts, and from then on it was happy as a clam. But they never failed because they were so over-designed. You know, I learned with manufacturing equipment, if you build something, no matter how delicate it is, you have to make it in such a way that it will withstand the rigors of the people that are going to use or abuse it. Whether you like it or not.
Right.
I mean, this is reality. And so you really have to go over the... I saw a movie one time of the company that built the wire wrapping tools. It was a company called Gardner Denver. They build mining equipment. Well, one of the things they did is they build these hand drills for drilling rock and stuff, and they made a special electric wire wrapping gun for us out of magnesium. And they recommended against it. They rather want to use something more sturdy, but we felt that, look, these things are going to be handled mostly by women, and we want to limit as much weight as possible.
Mm-hmm.
They said, they're making these pneumatic tools, which are their main business for Detroit. And what they did, they got these nut drivers with a pneumatic hose on them. And what they'll do is they'll run a few screws on one side, and they'll take this thing and fling it underneath the car carrier to the guy on the other side, who'll pick it up and use it to do the same thing on the other side. Well, after running these things back and forth on a concrete floor, they showed me pictures where they wore out right through the skin. I said, no, this is not that kind of an environment. Go ahead.
All right. Well, just to... So for how many months did you work on the Shockley-Jones Valdez?
In addition to a number of other projects, this is not the only project.
Right.
Well, we were making... we had to make everything. We were making four-point probes.
Mm-hmm.
Is lapping jigs to lap the silicon down to measure the diffusion depth.
Right.
Bobby Noyce wanted to do some work to figure out how to make aluminum conic, so we built a little shutter for him.
Mm-hmm.
To evaporate aluminum onto contacts. There's any number of things. We were working on how to make contact. First, you have to put the silicon on a header of some sort.
Right.
That had to be developed. Okay. Then you had to make a contact to that. Then you had to make the interconnect from there to a pin on the header to the outside world.
Right.
And then you had to encapsulate it. So each one of these required some work. And in addition to that, we had to slice silicon. So we went and got a grinding wheel machine, a surface grinder adapted to cutting slices of silicon,
mm-hmm.
and then lapping it to the right thickness. So we had there was that piece of equipment. And some of it you could buy and adapt, and some of it you couldn't. Evaporators, you just buy a bell jar and you have to do your own tooling inside.
Mm-hmm.
Diffusion furnaces, okay? Now, when I got there, Smoot Horsley was working, and I guess Bill Happ was working on a project where they were doing closed tube diffusion. You've heard of this?
Closed tube.
Closed tube diffusion. What they did was they took a piece of silicon and they put whatever doping they wanted in there and sealed it in a quartz tube and took this and put it in an oven for so many hours at such and such a temperature. They took it out, broke the quartz, and lapped it and measured the diffusion depth. I said, well, that may be an interesting way to do it in the lab, but for a production furnace, you got to be kidding.
Yeah.
Then, where there's another group working on open tube where they were taking, which is what we still do today. So there was that consideration. And then Nappy called me one day and he says, look, this RF generator has to have water running through it
mm-hmm.
all the time, and they're dumping it down and they're having a problem because there was no sewer there. They were on a septic tank. I said, you've got to be kidding. He says we need a cooling tower to cool the water so we can recirculate it. So he said, go get me a cooling tower. Because I studied air conditioning at one time, so I understood what that is. I said, I don't want to do this, but I got no choice. And what we wound up with is a wooden tower, which I hated but the only thing you can get in a hurry. If you wanted a real cooling tower, like a Baltimore Aircrow, which I'm more used to, which is a metal thing, which I know all about, it's going to last and you're going to do the job and you can measure it, but the wooden ones, who knows? They're not built for this kind of work, but they...
So I don't understand how you make a cooling tower out of wood.
You just squirt the warm water on the top and it dribbles down this cooling tower and comes out the bottom.
Okay.
So it's just a simple device with a fan in there of some sort, but it's all redwood.
And so the water's just running on the interior side.
It's terrible. You gotta clean it. It's gonna get. It gets dusty around there. You gotta do all kinds of construction. But the only thing I can get in a hurry. So for a while I was sitting. That was sitting on the roof, and for a long time that was the highest spot in all of Mountain View. They've since taken it down. This is one of a number of things that we did.
Well, in all of the crystal growing work and crystal production work that was going on that you were just describing at Shockley, was Sheldon Roberts involved in that?
Oh, yeah,
at all
Sheldon Roberts was involved in it. Vic Jones, mostly Vic Jones. And there was another fellow, I forgot his name, there were a few fellows that were involved in it. In fact, they were trying to get materials with different dopants in there.
Mean in the growing process?
Just to make seeds with, so they could use that to propagate. And they wanted some arsenic in there. I said, you got this is nasty stuff. You don't want to deal with this. So I made him get the gas masks and stuff like that. Because I don't like to deal with... gaseous arsenic, by the time you smell it, it's too late.
Yeah.
So, and then we had to deal with, how do you get rid of this acid? They were doing, not a lot of it, but some small amounts of pretty nasty things like aqua regia and fuming nitric and sulfuric and HCLs. You know, all the usual suspects that you find in a smelling there. And then they were dealing with solvents, acetone, alcohol, MEK, trichloroethylene, carbon tetrachloride, all the nasty things, but in small amounts.
Right.
But fortunately, there wasn't enough of a volume to cause anybody any great grief. And dealing with gases, you know, how you get high pure gases.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you, and you know, how do you distribute them around the place? Since, you know, and mechanical engineers are plumbers, right? So that was my problem. How to deal with the fittings and
the gas service for the lab.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became, and I guess from there evolved the fact that when we went to Fairchild, since I was the only one that had any experience at all with air conditioning, I was
got that job again.
And also electrical power distribution. Nobody knew from beans about that. So that's what I got. And distribution of gases, chemicals, air, electricity, water, DI water, another problem. And those days we were buying distilled water and running it through little laboratory ion exchange columns. RO, your reverse osmosis stuff, didn't exist then. In fact, millipore filters were classified. I think they were only using them for some, they became available later. So it was a problem treating, you know, hyperpure chemicals, water, gas, and distributing it to make sure it doesn't get contaminated, because every time you break the seal, God knows.
Right.
This is a mechanical problem, it becomes a chemical problem.
Yeah, right. Let me see, just to go back to the Shockley experience then, was it mostly then you and Eugene Kleiner and Dean Napick sort of tackling all these things together?
Yeah, Dean Napick was the manager, and he would handle us a project and leave it between Gene and I to decide who's going to do it, whether I would do it or he would do it, or we would both deal with it together.
Okay.
It was a very fluid, open relationship, and you know, it was one of those things. You know, you're not dealing with, there's no politics here. You know, this has to be done, and you know, who's the best guy to deal with it.
Right.
And if you don't know, you better get some help with someone who does. And, you know, the important issue was, you know, solving the problem in a timely fashion.
And you and Eugene Kleiner could do that, no problem.
No, any time we had a disagreement, we'd work it out until we both agree that this is the right way to do it. Or if it ain't the right way, we're doing it this way because of other reasons. Like we don't want to wait 6 months for it.
Right.
Because otherwise, you could live you'll never get anything to happen.
Now, did Dean Napick leave Shockley before you did?
About the same time.
And he went out to.
He formed KEP, Napick Electrophysics, where he was growing crystals. In fact, you know, he used the same crystal grower that I designed.
The same exact crystal
grower?
Crystal grower. I mean, did he take that same machine with him, or did he
reproduce it? Well, you know, it's not that complicated of a machine, and it's a generic thing anyway. So he asked me to look over the drawings to see if he missed anything. Fine, I don't care. It's as far as I'm concerned with public domain anyway. A Tchaikovsky puller is a Tchaikovsky puller, no matter how you do it.
Okay. And
in fact, Fairchild bought silicon from him.
Yeah, that's I had heard that.
Yeah, no, this was a. Yeah, they pulled their own silicon for a while. They, if they needed extra ones or they had a resistivity which they didn't, which wasn't in the mill, and they'd buy it, and they'd do it fine. We're a big customer, as a matter of fact.
Now, I know that Jones and Valdez left Shockley, I guess soon after that big first complex, or that big kludge.
Yeah, I think Valdez lost favor with Shockley over that. And Leo and Jones just couldn't handle that kind of atmosphere, and he wanted to get back to an academic environment. And he told Shockley that he wanted a different change, and Shockley said, "Well, I could get. I may have. I'll call Les Hogan, who was a professor at Harvard at the time, and tell him about and work a deal." So he called Hogan, and Hogan hired him.
Oh.
While he was a professor, I met Hogan years later. I told him about this. I said, "You know the Vic?" He said, "Of course, you know the Vic."
I didn't realize Hogan had been teaching.
Yeah, he was a professor at Harvard after he left Bell and before he went to Motorola.
Okay. Huh. Let me see. Maybe we could just talk about, could I ask you to talk a little bit about Eugene Kleiner in those days, just as a person, as a close coworker, as an engineer?
Well, Kleiner's experience mechanically was as a toolmaker. Mine was as a prosaic machinist. He didn't work on a high level, but it's all right. Between us, we could operate almost any machine known to man. He was better. He liked to do welding, so I left the welding to him. Now, whenever we'd have a peculiar project, like when we were working with molybdenum, for example, for the first time, I did the research and I did the procurement. I was the sort of the purchasing agent at the time, because I didn't want to start educating a clerk purchasing agent and buying technical stuff. It doesn't make any sense. By the time you waste doing that, you'll do it. I just needed to know where to get it at.
Right.
Now, when we were making these radiation shields, how are we going to get, we need sheets of molybdenum. At that time, I found out that there were two guys that made sheets, one by two different methods. One was sintered, and one was arc cast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And going through this, there was no strength involved. I just wanted something that was relatively easy to bend and drill holes through and deal with. And then we had to make little rivets or to fasten the thing together. I didn't want to stop doing, machining screws. So we just, drilled a hole and popped it just to hold it in place is all. It's not going to do anything else.
Right.
Just to hold this envelope together. And some machining that we did with a feed through, that required machining. And so for certain things, we got the arc cast and some we got the sinter, depending on what it was. Right? Now, when it came to machining, we both got together on the lathe, and he was on the lathe, and I was looking at the book that talked about how to deal with this stuff. Worrying about feeds and speeds. I said, it recommends using turpentine. It was, God, I've forgotten after all these years, as a lubricant.
Mm-hmm.
Why that material, I don't know, but that's what they were. So we got a jug of that and we put it on there, and it worked fine. Actually, we actually machined some screws out of it.
Hmm.
Gene did it, and we had a long debate on the feeds and speeds. And we ought to be a little. Let's stay within the realm, what they say. And we did the calculation, And we double-checked one another, and we finally went to agreement that was it. And the machinist was standing around watching us, the guys that were working. So when we finally did it, now they knew, no, that it worked, this is the right thing to do, and this is how you do it. It was turpentine, I think, that was used as a lubricant. But, you know, we were basically interchangeable. If we had a problem, his desk was right opposite mine anyway. So it was not such thing that it was my project, it was our project. If I needed him, if he needed to, if he put his words in it, fine. If I looked over his shoulder and I could say something, fine, then nobody ever took any offense over.
Did the two of you socialize outside of work, or did you need a break from one another?
No, we did some, you know, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We were close. In fact, he used to live up here, right next, up on the hill above us, until he and Rose are gone, you know, they're both gone now, you know. But he bought this property. I remember when he bought the land, he took me in his car to drive me up to show it to me. And I had no idea to buy a piece of property here. And a few years later, when this land became available, it turned out that he was right up there. I didn't pick it out that way.
What about, now, did you work at all at Shockley Semiconductor building those open type diffusion furnaces?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Was that something that you worked with Gordon Moore on?
Gordon and I, we worked on this fiasco of the platinum winding, which turned out to be...
I heard about that.
It worked for a while, but then the platinum sort of gave out. We went in his car up to a company in South San Francisco. I actually bought the platinum wire together.
Yeah.
But we came upon this material, this molybdenum disilicide made by this Swedish company called Canthol, that was capable of doing that job. I think they still use it to this day. So we ordered some of the first elements from them, custom wound, and we used the same thing at Fairchild as well.
And did... was Gordon taking care of the glass blowing aspect for the furnaces?
Yeah, Gordon did some of the the glass jungles, which were what was done in those. I remember watching him do this. He taught Art Lash to do this, and he finally got that off of his. Got rid of that chore. But some of the early work, everybody had to do a little of everything.
Well, maybe we could just talk a little bit about.
The diffusion furnaces were an editing store. We built these electrical controllers. We bought them from Barbara Coleman. And they were always dying for some reason or other. And I got a hold of Vic Greenwich, and then we looked at it and said, this is crazy. There's no reason why this thing shouldn't work. So we opened it up and looked inside. And I said, I can't believe these components are that cheesy. So between the two of us, what we did was we changed a capacitor, upgraded it 2 grades, instead of 150 volts, we made it 350 or whatever it was, and a bigger one, and a higher temperature one, and the transformer to drive the electronics was really just marginal. So we found one, I got one, I found one for him that was just a little bigger, so that it was not a problem. We retrofitted all of them. And we wrote to Barbara Coleman and said, look, why don't you make this change so we don't have to do it? And about 10 years later, they sent us back just what we decided to incorporate the change. I learned at Western Electric that when you specify components, electrical components, you really have to know what you're doing. Because you can't believe what the manufacturer tells you when he puts a rating on a component. Because he sort of means that as a sort of as a middle ground of where it ought to be. If you're really serious, you have to really measure it right. And in order for a piece of equipment to get qualified at West Electric, had to give a KS number, which was a Carney spec or whatever it was. Once you got blessed with that number, then you could supply that.
Okay.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
Which means that it had to really mean what it says it means. Raven, get in your bed. Come on. I know it's time for your dinner, but get in your bed.
Oh,
you want to go out? Come on.
Here, I'll just turn this off.